Welcome to The Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. This week, in addition to news, reviews, and more, we're joined by true crime aficionado Kevin Flynn to discuss this genre and how it's exploded into a juggernaut over the last few years. Now, let's kill us a show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today is Johnny Davenport.
Hey, Aaron. I'm a little excited about today.
We know. Joining us from Crime Writers On, and these are their stories, Kevin Flynn, a true crime writer and podcaster. Welcome aboard.
Hey, guys. Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I really do.
Tell people, because not everybody's a true crime aficionado, so tell people what it is you do, in both professionally and podcastery.
Yeah, I've been I've written several true crime books with my wife and writing partner Rebecca Lavoy, and they've focused on crimes that are here in New England. You know, we had a female serial killer, and we had vigilante shooting that went unsolved for 20 years, and like these are like cases that we find to be really fascinating because they involve, really interesting characters and a lot of, the story is great when you have a lot of premeditation or a lot of obfuscation after the crime. And so we wrote several books, and just at the time when the publishing industry started to dry up on their desire for selling $9 paperbacks when they could be selling $30 hardcover books, podcasting came along. And so since the birth of Serial and the explosion in true crime podcasts, we got on pretty early, and we have been podcasting from a little studio in our basement that we call Studio C. We should be calling it Studio B if it's basement. I think here in New England, it's a cellar, so Studio C kind of fits.
That really makes sense. I mean, it really does. That works together. I find it fascinating, especially these are their stories, because that podcast kind of takes, true crime is the rage right now, which we'll talk about a little later in the show. But it takes docudramas and the real life stories that inspired those docudramas and kind of makes, you kind of play off both of them, and you guys have fun with it, where most true crime is either too extreme in terms of it's really dour and I need a hug, or they're making too much light over people getting killed. So I think you guys have a really nice middle ground, a nice dichotomy of that.
Yeah, thanks. And while there is a, true crime retrospective element to these other stories, we don't think of it as a true crime podcast. It's primarily, the TV appreciation podcast, which you guys, know a lot about too. Award winners kicked our butt. it is sort of this extra thing that, one of the reasons why you could do a thing like a Law and Order podcast when there's been, no new episodes of regular Law and Order for a million years is that we've seen like these episodes in reruns over and over again. And we sometimes forget. We'll remember the story about the guy who said, you can't charge me, Your Honor. That flag's got fringes on it. It's a military court, We'll always remember that rerun. But we forget that there was a real life case behind that. And so we kind of bring that up and make that discussion too, because I think if you remember, you've seen the episode and then you'll hear a little more about the original crime. I think it provides context for both of those things.
It's fun, too. It is. It's a very
fun
show.
That's what we try to make it fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Thanks.
All right. Are you guys ready to get into some movie and TV?
Let's do it. Always.
Okay. Well, just a couple of quick casting tidbits to kick things off. Wesley Snipes and Eddie Murphy are teaming up for a Rudy Ray Moore biopic, or biopic, depending on how you like to hear it, called Dolomite Is My Name! Exclamation point. I think it's important to put emphasis on that. From Hustle and Flow director Craig Brewer, and Ewan McGregor is finally going to star as Danny Torrance. We've heard about this for a while in Mike Flanagan's adaptation of the sequel to The Shining, Dr. Sleep. Either one of these get you excited for either film?
At first, I got to say I was not excited at all because, I don't really care about this whole Dolomite movie, and I didn't like The Shining to begin with. But further reading into both of them, I'm excited to see Wesley Snipes and Eddie Murphy coming back to some sort of prominence. And it's really cool that they're going to do something on Netflix, because it's going to be much more accessible to everybody. And I think that's important. And I just, I liked how many layers that whole movie seems like it's going to end up having. And I care about Ewan McGregor as Danny Torrance only because it sounds like an interesting story. And I want to see that on film. Like, he's an alcoholic who helps people in a hospice center. And then he runs into a psychic kid and he's got to go save her. That sounds like a fun, interesting story.
Yeah, I also am looking forward to the Dr. Sleep film because, you know, for every great Stephen King movie, there is an equally horrible Stephen King movie.
Yes.
And I thought that the original Shining, despite the celebrity director, I thought was, you know, inferior to the book.
Oh, thank you, God. And thank you, baby Jesus. Thank you.
I'm sorry, am I blaspheming?
No, but, I get crucified for not enjoying that film constantly. So thank God.
Yeah, and I think that the ABC miniseries that they did in, I don't know, 80s or 90s, I thought was better than the film, and certainly a little, you know, truer to the book. Book, of course, in this case, was way better. So I haven't read Dr. Sleep, but, you know, to bring that character back, and, you know, if you can do it in a way that if it at least, you know, improves or maintains the quality of the book, then, you know, then go for it. But, you know, just, you know, for every green mile, there's maximum overdrive.
So. Yeah, we know about that one. Yeah. Hey, I think Wesley Snipes and Eddie Murphy, going back to that real quick, it's 20 years too late, but I don't care. I would love to see those two team up in any aspect of their career. I think they're both fantastic actors who have had, one in particular has had a pretty unfortunate run of events for the last few years. I'm looking forward to seeing those two in a film together. The Dr. Sleep film, though, I'm actually more excited about Mike Flanagan directing it because he's a really skillful director. He did Hush on Netflix, which I think is a great slow burn thriller. And I think he did, what, Oculus 2 or Ouija 2, I think it was. I don't remember which one. It was Ouija
2. 2.
Yeah, I think that's the one. And whatever it was. And it was he did a great job there. I just think he's a really talented director. I want to see what he does next. Don't really care about The Shining because, as I said, I'm not a big fan of the original movie, and I'm afraid it'll be more geared. I'm afraid that they're, even though King's book is going to be more what he intended, and they're going to try to stick to that book, I really feel like they're going to try to cater to Shining fans too, and that would concern me because I'm not a fan of that film.
You know, I always wait until you say you're not a fan of The Shining for me to say that I'm not a fan of The Shining because people just focus on you, and I get to say it and then walk away.
You're a pussy.
Yeah. Can we agree it's just not that great a movie, book or not? I just don't find it that good of a movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think like all the cinemaphiles were like, oh, I love the symbolism in it. And, you know, I think they just, you know, you sort of got away from what the essence of the story was, which was, you know, a guy who's an alcoholic who's, you know, trapped with his family, you know, on top of a mountain and the isolation of that. And you know, I just thought it just, you know, people hold it a little too precious for me.
Yes. And as soon as you say, yeah, I'm not a fan of The Shining. Oh, well, you don't understand cinema. Oh, okay. I think it's just pictures that move, right? That's just, yeah. But whatever.
Did anyone see, it was Room 247, I think was the name of the doc. And, you know, it was a look at it. They talked to like four or five fans or directors or whomever, and they all had like their different theories about everything in The Shining. And some of them were just cuckoo bananas. And, you know, it's not like, you know, an Alfred Hitchcock retrospective.
Right.
It was more like, oh, well, you know how he faked the moon landing. You know, it was like, no, come on, man.
What? Okay, I got to watch this now. I have not seen that, but I really want to watch that now.
Oh yeah.
Kubrick faked the moon landing. Of course he did. Why wouldn't he?
Yeah, well, I guess he was rumored to have, I mean, rumored, the conspiracy nation out there said that, you know, not only was, you know, the moon landing faked, but it was directed by Kubrick because, I don't know, he had such a big hit with 2001. I don't know what the reason was, but...
It makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? I mean, because you want all that pathos when you come down the stairs.
Lord. It would be much more hyper realized it would just be insane if he did it. It would be like taking LSD, honestly. That's what the moon landing would be like. It would be like you were high as a kite if he filmed it. There's no way he caters it. He brings it down. He's not going to bring it down to a regular director's level. I'm too much of an auteur.
I think that one of my favorite lines about that is that it would actually be cheaper to send somebody to the moon back then than it would have been to fake it.
Right. That's true.
Well, craft services would just be Tang, so it would have been really cheap.
The podcast S-Town, which follows an Alabaman horologist named John McLemore.
McLemore, yeah.
Who sent an email to the creators of This American Life back in 2012 asking for help in a murder investigation, is being turned into a film from Spotlight and Up writer Tom McCarthy. We're all pretty ecstatic for podcasts because we all do it, but is this even a filmable story?
I think so.
Okay, how so?
Have you guys seen, listened to S-Town?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, one of the better podcasts, really, of the past couple of years. I mean, it's right up there. No, you don't think so? I think it's...
Okay. I'm not a fan. I guess yeah. I will say I'm not a fan because I felt like it became more exploitative.
Well, yeah, there is that problem at the end. But do you like it better than The Shining?
Yes, I definitely like it better than The Shining.
I think that if the movie were to include Brian, and I can't remember his last name, the reporter, but was it Brian Reed? No, yes. I don't think so. Was it Brian Reed? Oh, yeah. If they included him as a character and it is sort of, again, told through his eyes as opposed – I mean, I think you have to do it that way because you can't really tell the story of John McLemore's life, without – I mean, a lot of it is like what happens after he dies, too. So I think that, that it has the spine of enough of a story that you can do that. And you can kind of skip over some of the parts of the podcast where they kind of dig, I think, spend a little too much time on his sex life. Mm-hmm. And some of the dangerous choices that he made in that way. I'm not saying that to be homosexual is dangerous, but I think we can agree that whether you're homosexual or heterosexual, picking up strangers, bringing them back to your house is not necessarily, the best way to live your life.
Well, it's kind of like Tinder Express, really.
Yes. Tinder Express, yes. And apparently, we know that he also loves plants in the same way that Harvey Weinstein
it's
does.
Sad. I saw where you're going with that one.
Yeah, but I think it could be. I think it could be, and I think in the way of like all the president's men, where you're seeing not the story, but the story through the eyes of a journalist narrator. I think that. I mean, I already can imagine the final scene where it's like he finally starts the podcast and it's like you just hear the voiceover of the first 2 minute introduction to the podcast, and it's a voiceover where you see all the other characters going out to get the mail and sort of going living their lives, and this coda at the end, and it'd be all schlocky.
I like the idea of being a movie, and I think picture this S-Town with the dragon tattoo. Huh?
Wait, what?
Essentially, take the podcast S-Town, smash in elements from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and I think we have a real good, an interesting story.
The interviewer, instead of being, what was his name again? Brian Reed?
Yeah.
Instead of being Brian Reed, it would be some crazy woman who's tatted up and, just running out
there. No, it'd still be Brian Reed, but he'd have a sidekick with him who saves him from all the real things that was fake in the podcast. Ended up not being real in the podcast.
See, here's my thing. Listening to the podcast, it became very frustrating for me because I just, like I said, I feel like the story was being exploited a little bit as it went along. And I didn't like that because the poor guy, I don't want to spoil it for anybody that hasn't listened. You know why once you listen to it. But I really feel like the writer, having Tom McCarthy behind it, who wrote Up and he wrote Spotlight, two great, great films, that's really what got me interested in it. For a guy who doesn't like S-Town for many reasons, I also, I mean, it's an innovative podcast. It really is. I'm not knocking that. I just, as it went along, it became harder for me to listen to. But I think Tom McCarthy could make something great out of that. I really, really do. I think he's one of the best writers currently working. So, man, I mean, he could tell John's story in the first 5 minutes and bring us all the tears.
Right.
And then we could spend, oh, okay, here's what S-Town and The Shining have in common.
Oh, boy.
It's that the topiary maze in the backyard.
Yes.
Only instead of Jack Nicholson getting frozen to death in the back, you could just have Brian Reed, the character, stumbling along, trying to find his way out.
Hmm.
Of course, my understanding is that John McLemore's maze was only about knee high.
Yeah.
So, saying, oh, I got lost in this maze. It's great symbolism, but it's kind of a stupid visual. It's like, really, you can't find your way out? How about you just step over it?
I kind of would rather at this point have Jack Nicklaus, because I think he's a golfer, and it could just be confusing for everyone. Like, why is he here? I don't understand. I mean, they couldn't get Nicholson. They can't afford him.
Yeah.
Nicholson can't even remember the script anymore. So it's
hey.
All right.
He's still one of the greatest of all time until somebody says something horrible about him, which would probably happen any minute.
Well, he was in The Shining, so.
I love you. You can come back anytime. George Lucas finally elaborated a bit on what his plans for Star Wars Episode 7, 8, and 9 were, and I got to read this before you respond, so I'd love to hear what you guys think of what George Lucas would have done had he done it. They were going to get into a microbiotic world, but there's this world of creatures that operate differently than we do. I call them the Wills, and the Wills are the ones who actually control the universe. They feed off the Force. Back in the day, I assume that was a Wednesday, I used to say ultimately what this means is we were just cars, vehicles for the Wills to travel around in. We're vessels for them, and the conduit is the midichlorians. Oh, God. The midichlorians are the ones that communicate with the Wills. The Wills, in a general sense, they are the Force. All the way back to, with the Force and the Jedi and everything, the whole concept of how things happen was laid out completely from the beginning to the end. But I never got to finish. I never got to tell people about it.
And you never should.
You never, ever should say those words ever again.
Come on! It doesn't sound magical to you.
Well, this is what I think happened. So everyone started doing these petitions about inviting JJ to leave the planet. Ryan Johnson's head on a stick. All these different petitions, because everyone was so mad about everything that's happening with this current generation of Star Wars movie. And it got back to George Lucas, and he's like,
"Let me think of how I can get out of this. Let me give you the worst story possible."
And that's what I think is actually happening.
That's very optimistic.
If only.
Yeah, right.
If only it were just, I need to change the message by coming up with an alternative storyline, which was even worse. It's like, Jar Jar Binks becomes the new emperor. And, could you just like take all of the crappy stuff you didn't like about the prequels and just show that, your best days were behind you. I'm so glad that they sold to Disney, because it just could not possibly have been worse than that.
I want to see this trilogy now. I really do. I want to see. You think this is a good idea? I would love for somebody to just say, you know what, George, we're going to let you. Well, I'm sure he could make it with his own money, but get out there and make that money. Yeah, make that movie with, different characters. I don't even think Disney's going to care. I think they would love to see this on the screen so they could say, hey, we're not so bad, right? I mean, we're actually doing things pretty well.
You just want to watch the world burn at this point, Aaron.
I really do. Yeah. This is the kind of thing that drives me crazy, because you do have these fans that are just rioting at this point because the last couple movies haven't been everything they wanted in the whole wide world. They're Monday morning quarterbacking the Star Wars films. If they could write better, I guess. I don't know. Then go to Hollywood and write. And then you hear this kind of thing, which is where the prequels were already headed. If you saw the prequels, nobody speaks highly of them except for a couple set pieces. So why would you want it back in Lucas's hand? Why wouldn't you? Yay, this isn't.
You wouldn't.
Exactly. This proves you would not. You should be thankful for what you've got. You know what? You should. It's kind of like the kid that gets his ass beat because he got a toy and he complained about it. Be thankful you got what you got, because it's better than what you could have got. That's all I'm saying.
It's like when you hear about that mother that they need to take the baby away from. Like, for everybody's own good.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, I'm very sorry, you know, but this, you're just going to do something bad to this kid. So
absolutely,
we're going to just quietly take him away and give him to, you know, a guy with curly hair and glasses, and let's see what he can do with
it. That's a great analogy. Disney is the DCFS of the cinematic world.
It is. It is.
They save Marvel. They save Star Wars. What else? I think they're just going to save Fox.
For once, I don't care about ripping away a child from its parents. It's like, sorry, George, this was just stupid.
You were not treating that kid respectfully. You just weren't.
That's right, yeah.
All right, well, we got a couple things we're going to review before we move on to some new releases. And Kevin, you've been watching a show called Killing Eve, which is a BBC series about an operative and an assassin going head-to-head, starring Sandra Oh and Jodie Comer. How is it?
Yeah. It is great. It is great. The series just finished its run on BBC America, and it will be on Hulu next year. You can, if you still have BBC America access to it, you can get it on demand. In fact, I think BBC America is actually distributed by AMC, so I think it's part of that cluster of networks. But yeah, it's really good because it's the villain in this the assassin, mm-hmm, is such a fun character. When you think about like professional assassins, when they do them in a TV or show or whatever, it's either like the very cool professional, nothing shakes them assassin, or somebody with the, you know, scar and green teeth and, you know, the chip on their shoulder. And this is just a beautiful woman who is playfully enjoying her own. She's self-aware about being a psychopath, mm-hmm, and just is enjoying everything that she does. The dialogue is fantastic. It reminds me of Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Veronica Mars.
Really? That good?
Yeah. That good? Not, you know, not as rapid, but it has a couple of lines which are just great. There's finally a, and this isn't a spoiler, but there's finally a meeting between Sandra Oh's character, the desk jockey who ends up having her own special secret forces team looking for the assassin. And she meets up with Villanelle, who is the assassin, and they have sort of this this discussion, and she says, you know, I know about you, you're a psychopath. And her line was, you shouldn't tell a psychopath they're a psychopath. It upsets them. And I just think, like, that's, yes, of course it does. And just, so she's scary without being menacing. And the only other thing that I want to mention about this is the networks say this is the first time in a decade that they can find any TV show whose audience grew every subsequent week of the series. So instead of doing like the big, you know, premiere and then losing audience eventually, it gained audience in every demographic, every subsequent week, you know, partly on, you know, word of mouth and the fact that people can binge it and catch up to the, you know, to whatever the current week was. So I think that it's really enjoyable.
I've heard a lot of people rave about that show. A lot of people. But the comparison to Buffy and Veronica Mars, believe it or not, all the people raving about it that I actually know, and I've known them for years, and I respect their opinion, none of them have talked me into watching it. Hearing that it compares to Buffy and Veronica Mars is really all I needed to do. That's all I could have said. Now, okay, I'm in. So now I'll check it out. All right, let's move on to Tag. Tag stars Ed Helms, John Hamm, Hannibal Buress, Jake Johnson, and Jeremy Renner, and they're five friends who every May for 1 month, an entire month, they play the most elaborate game of tag you have ever seen. This year, Jeremy Renner's character is actually getting married, and he plans to retire, never being tagged. While the other four friends and Helms' kooky wife has decided to finally tag him once and for all. So that's the plot of the movie. They're a bunch of friends playing a game of tag, and it's based on a true story, and you actually We'll see the friends in the context of the film. John, what did you, and Kevin, feel free to interject if you have any questions or thoughts. John, what did you think about Tag?
Sometimes when I watch a comedy like this, you can always, I sit there and I watch it and I think, all right, well, there's bits and pieces of this that are really good. This feels contrived. This feels kind of whatever. Tag actually did a really good job of just selling me on the whole concept. It had characters that, even though in some cases they're kind of cartoonish and weird, they still felt real and they still felt like my real friends. And it's a lot of fun, and it has a great message to it, and the message carries all the way through. And I thought at one point, for me, I thought that I had figured out what the ending of the whole thing, the whole shebang, was going to end up being, but they took a really strange right turn, and it was better than I expected it to be, and had much more heart and joy to it. What about you, Aaron?
Yeah, I will say that's the one thing that surprised me the most, because as it went on, I really felt like it wasn't as predictable as I thought it would be. It wasn't right. nearly as predictable. I really thought the humor was hysterical. The fact that these guys were just having a blast, and you have professionals, you have people in their professional primes playing tag. And I'm sitting there in my seat, you know, a grown ass man going, I really wish I had friends that would do this, because this would be great. This would be fun. Just for one month, destroying property and having a hell of a lot of fun, jumping through windows, ninja movements, whatever. It was a lot of fun. And the best thing about it was, as insane as the movie is, and believe me, half of it you can't buy. I mean, it's just some of it is insane. But the friendship that it's trying to demonstrate is really charming and really just, it really gets you right in the heart. I mean, by the end of the movie, I actually felt for every single one of them. I wish I had I do have a close bond with friends, but nothing, this feels like something really unique and special. And the whole mantra that they keep saying about playing games and how it's important to continue playing because you get old when you stop playing games. And I think that's just something we should all probably adopt. It's actually a really heartfelt, hysterical R-rated comedy. I really had way more fun with it than I thought I ever would.
I haven't seen the film yet, but I did see some news stories with some of the friends. Mm-hmm. They say that some of the, you know, tag scenarios that, you know, were in the film were, you know, actually happened. Apparently the one where the guy tagged the friend at his father's funeral was a real thing that happened.
That's amazing.
Just came up behind him and said, I'm sorry about your father.
Well, they're, at That's the end amazing. Of the movie, they actually break down all the ones that they have video of, and they showcase very many of them throughout the movie. So it was very cool seeing the actual thing happen.
Was one of the characters a priest?
No.
Because in real life, one of the guys is a priest.
No.
Yeah.
That would have been more fun to play with.
Yes, I thought
Why
so.
Why wouldn't you tag him in a confessional? That would be amazing to watch.
Oh, that'd be great.
Forgive me, Father, for you
that
are
would
it.
Be great.
That would be great.
Rewrite.
No, it was. Everybody, I think, should check out that movie. And John, Kevin, you're not familiar with our scoring system. We go on $10. So if $10 is the full price of admission, John, what do you give tag?
It was $7 easy.
Okay. I give it $7.50. I actually enjoy. I didn't like the trailer. I think I'm the only person that didn't like the trailer, and I really enjoyed the movie itself.
I think the trailer that I really liked the most was the part where Jeremy Renner's just talking to the camera, and then all of a sudden everybody shows up behind him, where it's just where he's playing Jeremy Renner, and it's like they're playing an actual game of tag, and then they cut into the trailer. That preamble was the part that I liked the most.
Yeah, my favorite thing leaving the movie, and we'll move on, but is walking into it. I'm trying to understand, how does a guy go 20, 30 years, whatever, without being tagged? How is that possible? You're gonna have to sell me on that. And then of course he's Batman. That's why. So it plays up. All right. And we also have, let's see, what's the other one? Flinttown. Flinttown follows the police department in Flint, Michigan as they deal with contaminated water and excessive violence. And I think it's on Netflix, Kevin. How is this?
Oh, it's actually really, really good. It's an 8-part series from Netflix, and you're right. It follows the Flint Police Department for about 1 year. Throughout 2016, and you get very intimate views of a couple of different cops, but more broadly, members of the community, you know, the police chief. You have the backdrop of the water crisis, the presidential election, all these things going on with our changing attitudes about law enforcement and police officers. This was during the time of the Philando Castillo shooting that was caught on Facebook Live. We had the Dallas ambush of different police officers. And so it checks all these boxes as far as all the themes that you would want it to cover, like you know, minority relations and, you know, problems with the militarization of police and how do you deal with high crime in poverty-stricken areas. But it also is able to tell an actual story, you know, throughout this while still touching on all these different things. You've got a, you know, a beautiful female patrol officer who wants to become an FBI agent. She's dating a sergeant who treats her nice but is, you know, sort of quasi-racist and has all of the – expresses all of the things that you think are wrong about police officers. And you've got a guy who's in the police academy along with his mother, who's also in the police academy. So I think it's really great, and it's beautifully shot. It's probably, you know, visually speaking, one of the best documentaries we've seen from Netflix in a long, long time.
Wow. That really, they actually allowed them to capture all that, especially the semi-racist cop.
Yeah, well, you know, they were all in, you know, the documentarians were all embedded in, you know, different police cars. Mm-hmm. And you always, occasionally, you know, at least once an episode, you get the cops kind of thing where, you know, they're rushing to something. And you'll definitely get like at least 5 to 10 straight seconds of just the car revving and the view outside the window of things zipping by. And you're like, oh, what are we going to get at? But yeah, it really just made the cops so comfortable. There's a series of just two camera interviews, in just sort of a black backdrop, and they were just so comfortable. They're able to just sort of talk about, you know, what they thought. Now, the officer I'm referring to, the sergeant, I mean, he wasn't dropping N-bombs or anything like that, but you just kind of tell, like, you know, that he's dismissive of the concerns about race. Mm-hmm. Whereas the black officers are really interesting because they're torn. They are very proud of what they do for a living, but they also are conflicted about how members of the black community are treated. There was one officer who said, I wear the uniform, but I also fit the profile. So, you know, I think it covers on all these different things while still giving you a really interesting look at what happens when you have a city that's among the 5 most violent in the country, and they are understaffed, but they only have 100 cops for a city of 100,000 people.
Is Michael Moore involved with that at all?
No. Oh. No, not that I know of. No, he isn't listed anywhere as executive producer or anything like that. But I don't know. It's just beautifully shot too. I mean, it begins in November and December, so it starts to snow and it's Christmas, and it just the bleakness of like fresh white snow and red and blue lights zipping through streets. And, you know, it's really something to behold.
I'm definitely going to, those are two shows. I'm going to check both of them out. So thanks.
Yeah, I say try one and you're probably going to stick around for the rest.
All right. Well, John, let's go to some new releases.
All right. So we have one major release in the theater this weekend, at least to make it sound like it. Jurassic World on June 22nd. When the island's dormant volcano begins roaring to life, Owen and Claire mount the dumbest campaign to go rescue the remaining dinosaurs from this extinction level event. Yet that's still dumb. They already were extinct. Let's just leave them there. Anyhow, this is directed by J.A. Boyana, starring Chris, I Lost the Infinity War, Pratt, Bryce Dallas, I Sprint in High Heels, Howard, Rafe, not Ralph, Spall, and Justice, Don't Call Me Jaden Smith.
Nice.
That's the only one I did that for. I didn't do it. I'm not going to do it for the rest of them.
No,
all right.
I kind of insist you do it. No, I'm just kidding. Don't do it.
Something I'm really, really interested in checking out. Also on the 22nd, on VOD, we have The Catcher Was a Spy. Based on a true story, during World War II, a Major League Baseball player, Mo Berg, lives a double life working for the Office of Strategic Services. This is directed by Ben Lewin, stars Paul Rudd, Paul Giamatti, Connie Nielsen, and Mark Strong. Again, check out this trailer. It looks pretty awesome. I can't believe it's only on VOD. And then follow that by, on June 22nd, we have on VOD, Gemini. A heinous crime tests a complex relationship between a tenacious personal assistant and her Hollywood starlet boss. As the assistant unravels a mystery, she must confront her own understanding of friendship, truth, and celebrity. This stars Lola Kirkey, Zoe Kravitz, John Cho, Greta Lee, and it's directed by Aaron Katz. And it's, again, a very interesting VOD movie. I think it did pretty well at South by Southwest. Do you know, Aaron?
I heard it went well. I was at South by, but I didn't see this one.
From what I can tell, this is something you probably missed there.
It looks like it'd be really good. Showings didn't match up, so I didn't get to see it. I was very sad and angry.
And then finally, on Netflix, we have season two of both Luke Cage and Glow. It's a Sophie's choice for me. All right. So, Kevin, you are our guest. Of these options, which one do you think you're going to see this week?
Glow. Yeah. And you think I'm lying. You think I'm full of shit right now. But God is my witness. I am wearing a head sweatband that says Glow on it.
What?
That is awesome.
Yes, and I've got the matching wristbands, and I had a jacket that has Glow. Somebody who was a fan of our podcast worked on the set. And everybody got a goodie bag, which was a gym bag filled with all sorts of swag from Glow, and he sent it to us. And it is, at the time we were recording this, 157 degrees Fahrenheit in my studio, and I am sweating. Science. So I was like, you know, this is stupid 80s technology, but I'm going to wear this because no one is going to see me and will know. So I just outed myself.
Well, if anyone's going to out you, might as well be you.
Might as well be me. Yeah. I can own it.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, I'm going to be watching Glow.
Wow.
Aaron?
Now I kind of want to watch Glow, but only if Kevin's going to be in it, because I want to see this look. I got to see this look. It sounds great. I like Glow's first season. I did not like Luke Cage's first season, so I'll definitely see Glow. But Catcher was a Spy. That's the one I want to see. I agree with you, John. I saw the cover, and I went, no. Mm-hmm. Then I watched the trailer and went, you know what? I'm in. Paul Rudd also never ages, so I got to find out how he does it.
Glow is for sure on my list of things. Luke Cage, if I can find some time over the weekend, yeah, I'll check it out. But I'm most excited about The Catcher was the Spy, and Jurassic World, oddly enough, that's one that if I can make time for it, I will. Otherwise, I can just wait till VOD for that one.
I mean, I'm going to see it, but I'm just saying, I love an independent title, especially one that sneaks up on you. So, there you go.
Well, way to make me feel bad.
Yeah. I mean, hey, you know, if you really want to feel bad, grab a bandana, throw it on your head, be like Kevin.
Kevin doesn't sound like he feels bad at all.
No, he doesn't, and he shouldn't.
I don't. I'll send you a photo.
Please do, so I can put it.
Take a selfie.
Can I put it on the internet and just say, "Hey, that's Kevin."
Yeah. Explain this, Flynn.
Well, let's be honest. It's not the worst thing of you that's been on the internet.
No, it's probably not. Probably not.
That's amazing. What a great gift bag, though.
Yeah.
Aaron, I'm a little disappointed that you can't get us fans that work on different shows to get us cool stuff.
No,
like
every
that.
Time I talk to a director, they want to send stuff like pens or, you know, something like, or a hat, a trucker's hat. You know what? I got enough of that. I don't need any. Sweatband? That's never come up because I would take it in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it also came with tube socks.
Get out!
That were long and they had like yellow stripes on them. It's like, oh, wow, these are like total 80s socks. I mean, the attention to detail was fantastic.
That's the only really great swag I've got, which was interesting, was I got the black hat from Westworld when I went to the Westworld experience. Now that was pretty cool to get that.
Hitchcock watch.
Oh yeah, I did. Director sent me a Hitchcock watch. That was pretty amazing. Oh. I guess I feel horrible that I didn't remember that off the top of my head. So we're just going to move on. Okay. He's only my favorite director of all time, but whatever. All right.
Way to go, Aaron.
Our From the Outside In topic this week is going to be true crime. Now, if you remember back in the 80s and 90s, television began the trend of discussing true crime as entertainment with shows like Unsolved Mysteries and Cops. Man, I watched a lot of Unsolved Mysteries. There have always been shows devoted to investigative reporting, but Unsolved Mysteries really seems to be the one that when people think about it, they refer to as true crime and when that took off. The genre continued to explode, arriving at our current moment with juggernaut docuseries such as Making a Murderer, Evil Genius. There's a lot of scripted true crime now revolving around the OJ case and Versace. That obviously bleeds over into Kevin's world as both a writer and as true crime podcasts have exploded as the most popular podcast genre. I mean, you're actually kind of riding both sides of that one pretty skillfully. So the biggest question I have is, why are people so fascinated with these horrible things that happen to other people? And do you think it's a healthy form of entertainment?
We're fascinated by it because we're sick.
Yeah. That's fair.
No, actually, I don't think that at all. I mean, we as people have always been interested in this kind of story. I mean, it goes back to the story of Cain and Abel is the first crime story. And I think one of the reasons why we are interested in true crime is because, A, there is a Sherlock Holmes kind of element to it where we are vicariously trying to solve the crime in certain cases. Also, there have been studies done and people have put out there that they believe why women are drawn to true crime has to do in part with their desire to want to feel safe. I think that there's something to that. The reason, you know, we watch horror movies is to get a rush of adrenaline, like being afraid, but in a safe way. We know that we're not going to get hurt. So when we watch true crime, some people, you know, who have fears about being victimized or have been victimized in the past and are looking for a way to, in a fantasy world, to get justice, this is a way to see people get justice. But the stories of true crime, what is popular with the public, has started to swing away from the story where the cop gets his man and the bad guy gets his comeuppance, to stories about where the justice system has failed. I think we can credit or blame Serial for that. Not only did Serial basically set the template for what every podcast is trying to be, you know, a weekly series mm-hmm. that, you know, hopefully gets crowdsourced into solving some unsolvable crime, but also has swung the pendulum away from the idea of true crime being let's get the bad guy and find out how that happens to, let's undo the wrong that has been created by the system.
And you think it is healthy for people?
Yeah, you know, I think so. Yeah, I mean, there are those that, you know, take it to the point where they're going to get out of their armchair and start trying to solve it because they're stupid.
Yeah.
But, you know, those folks aside, you know, and then some of them, like, go on and they make a podcast and they talk about how they're going to solve this case that, you know, the police have been looking at this for 35 years. But I, who have no formal investigative experience whatsoever, am going to solve this in 8 weeks.
They have a microphone, Kevin. That's
they have
amazing.
A microphone. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a powerful thing in having a microphone. I mean,
it's a DNA probing microphone.
Exactly. So, I mean, other than that, yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm going on the side that this is an okay thing to consume as a media consumer, if for no other reason than it pays the bills for me, and it would be stupid for me to say otherwise.
John, why do you like true crime so much, and do you think it's healthy?
I don't know if it's healthy or not, because me saying it's healthy would be kind of like saying, "Hey, I'm perfectly sane." It's nobody who's actually sane will say that, but I think it has a lot to do with the idea that as human beings, we do want to feel that rush, and we want to be able to feel that rush in a safe place. So you don't see raccoons out in the woods, like one jumps out from behind a tree wearing the mask, like, "Ah, Bob, where are you going? It's just me, Steve." You don't see animals do that.
Where is this going?
I don't know yet.
Talking about human nature.
Right. Oh, okay. All right.
Well, Kevin got it. Aaron.
Oh, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, though, John. So.
Yeah. So I think it's partly that where we just, as people, like that feeling, like our hearts beating quickly for a good scare to be involved. But I also think in some cases it's kind of like going to the zoo when it comes to watching a lot of documentaries, where we want to be able to see the things that are out there that are really scary, but from the safety of behind the fence. And it is exciting, and it makes us feel like we're more educated and like we know more, but we can do that from a safe distance where we can walk away from it as well.
For me personally, the reason why I get into it is I am fascinated with psychology. I have been for a long time. So I want to know why people do what they do.
Right.
And I can get why someone's going to, you know, a guy has an affair. I get that. That's not hard to figure out. You know, a guy drunk driving. I can understand that pretty quickly. Why someone will do horrible things, I don't quite understand. And there, as when you start to dive into true crime, what you find is that there are things you never thought anyone would ever do or could ever happen to anyone, and they've happened, and in fact have been worse than you could ever imagine. And I can imagine some bad stuff. I love horror movies. So when I started diving into it, it was fascinating to me, as well as cathartic in a way, because I'm like, wow, I thought I knew everything about human nature, and there's so much more that is there. And by diving into that, I kind of learned a little bit more about the darker side of human nature and what people can do and what they will do and why they do what they do. And those are my favorite kinds of series and documentaries and podcasts, are the ones that really dive into the why they did what they did. Because a lot of times it's not simply he snapped or anything like that. Like there's reasons, not justifiable or anything like that, but there are reasons why this happened. And I just find it fascinating to follow that road. Now, it's healthy as long as you don't get carried away with it. I have had to pull myself away from true crime a couple times. Like, why am I, you know, up at 3 a.m. putting a, you know, a chair against the door? That feels excessive. You know, why am I calling my kids and, hey, did you get to the car? Are you on the road? Where are you at? You know, when you start doing those kinds of things, which I'm guilty of doing a time or two, you have to start pulling yourself back going, okay, that's not healthy.
You go for a run in the woods and you wonder whether or not that guy walking with the kid in the woods is going to be walking out with the kid?
I have actually been terrified going for a run at the park because I was listening to a true crime. This is a true story. It was true crime. I think it was. And I was listening to a story, and it was, I don't remember which podcast it was, but I was listening to a podcast. I was running through the woods. It was daytime, but there's nobody there. It was very isolated, desolate. And as I run through, there was a big turn in the story, which, as you know, Kevin, is important to a true crime podcast. Have that turn where you didn't see it coming. Well, I didn't see it coming and almost ran into a tree. So
you didn't see the tree coming either, apparently.
No, I didn't. I'm just running, and I got so petrified that I could never have imagined it went that direction, and it just took me completely off guard. And I almost ran into a tree. And I already am klutzy enough on a trail, so I don't need that. I don't need that. It's very dramatic. So we all see the final product. Can you take us through what your process is to write about a true crime event? Because I think everybody gets fascinated by that concept.
Yeah, if we're doing you know, the kind of things when we were writing a book, the thing that publishers want, again, is a story that first of all, it has to be completely adjudicated. Unless you're talking about like a Casey Anthony kind of thing and you're trying to do a crash book and like get it out first, you know, a lot of times publishers wanted to make sure that the guy that is your bad guy doesn't win on appeal, and now your book is, you know, quasi libelous because you said he did all these horrible things to his ex-wife. So, you know, the process ends up being kind of like what you would think. You know, a lot of interviews. There's a lot of records and documents to go through. Police investigative files are fantastic, in part because they have interviewed all the people that you probably would like to interview. And if you can't get a hold of the sister, you know, she doesn't want to talk to you. Well, she talked to the police, and you've got a transcript 50 pages long of her telling, you know, about her life and about her relationships and whatnot. So that's always a great resource. You know, as far as, you know, writing the book, you know, there's, you know, about 8 months of writing and then 8 months of post-production of line edits and, you know, going through legal and getting a cover done and all that other stuff. So I say, you know, it takes, you know, almost as long to gestate an elephant as it does to write a true crime book. But it's, in a way, it's just like any other sort of journalism, where you put the time in, you gather the news, and you think of a way to tell a story that is compelling, yet you know, adheres to the truth and to certain ethical standards. You know, you don't want to you know, just all of a sudden give the guy an evil twin brother when he didn't have one. So there's a lot of that, and I think that, you know, where Rebecca and I would, you know, work together, you know, we'd play off each other and just try to make sure, like, is this good? And I think that's kind of where the good stuff comes from.
Is it easier for you to work together on it as opposed to doing a solo outing?
Oh, well, you know, writing with your wife is like moving a couch for 6 months.
3 inches to the left. No, not
yeah,
moving back.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually had it by the end. we actually got a sort of a good thing going where I would sort of write the first drafts and get like the story arc figured out. And, you know, the order of things that we're going to talk about. And then she would come in behind and polish up all the prose and get it that way. Then we would sort of divvy up the assignments of, you know, you go talk to this guy, I'll go to the courthouse, that kind of a thing. So, yeah, it was good. It was good because, you know, it was the only time where we could have a mediated marital dispute. Because, you know, if we had a fight about, we always fought about, and it was probably the only thing we ever would fight about in every book, was how to begin. You know, are we going to use this anecdote? Are we going to start it here, you know, at the murderer, but we don't know who the murderer is? And so we'd always have a difference of opinion, but we could go to our editor and say, which one of these is better? And so the editor always picked my view, and it's the only time I ever won an argument in my marriage.
That's fair. How is it to when you're fact checking? Because I assume that's probably the hardest part is when you have, I don't know, when somebody is speculating and you have to confirm it, or you have to confirm or deny what they're speculating about. How do you approach that?
Well, you know, working backwards here, once the, you know, the book is written and everything sort of edited nicely, it goes to a lawyer at the publishing house, and he or she will make a bunch of notes, and then you have a nice 6-hour telephone call where they say, okay, on page 17, you say that you know, the uncle was an alcoholic. How do you know that? You know, can you attribute that to a document or you know, an interview that you did? So like every single thing they go through. One of the, you know, interesting things that I found, and this is very helpful that you should know in the future, mm-hmm. is that you can't libel a dead person. A dead person does not have an expectation of privacy rights. Except I think, you know, crazily, like with your, you know, HIPAA medical history or something like that. But, you know, it would be like, oh, you know, this guy's an alcoholic. How do you know that? And we just say, oh, he's dead. So, okay, doesn't matter. Move on. But, you know, fact checking, I think it's just like you would for any other, for any other newspaper, magazine story. You attribute the information to the proper places. If it's, you know, if this is a statement made by the cousin, then you say, you know, the cousin says you attribute it to that person. You know, if there's a way to, you know, go around and check against other records or other statements that were made by other people that they made at other times, you know, that's kind of how it goes down. So, you know, I think in a way it's probably much easier to write, you know, fiction, because you could just do this stuff. But, you know, with true crime and nonfiction, you know, the story's already written. And they say this shit just writes itself. So it's more about putting together all of the facts so that you could explain to a lawyer, yeah, I got it all right.
One of my questions that have come up several times from talking with friends and saying, hey, we're going to have Kevin Fleet on. He's going to talk about true crime. What would you say you want to know from someone who works on true crime? And the number one question I got was, why?
Who is Kevin Flynn?
No. Everybody knew who you were. They're just like, oh, Kev? They must have called you Kev. Or Big F. I don't know what that meant, but they called you Big F.
Yeah.
So, Big F. No, but the number one thing that kept coming up was, why does he do it? Because I think everybody knows that you don't get rich and famous usually from doing true crime. So what drives you to want to do that?
Well, I always wanted to, you know, write a book. You know, I was a journalist, radio, TV, and, you know, just the thing that everybody said is like, oh, your skill is, you know, you write very well. So when I was in radio, they said, oh, well, you know, you have the voice of a newspaper reporter. And I'm like, what? You don't like my voice? And then when they, you know, I was in TV, they said, well, you have the face for radio. And so I've always been, you know, physically inadequate for the job that I have. But I just always wanted to write a book. And when the first crime case that I wrote about came up, the Sheila LaBar case, you know, when, just about, you know, 10 minutes into figuring out, you know, what this murder mystery that I've started to cover was, I'm like, oh, this is probably going to be the book. And, you know, you get an agent and you kind of get on the treadmill and you're like, okay, we got to keep, you know, got to keep writing this stuff. Well, one of these days, one of these books, you know, might be a Lifetime movie. Who knows? But I just, you know, I've got stories to tell. So that's kind of why I do. You're right. If I were Stephen King, then I could, you know, write in the morning and read in the afternoon and, you know, drink fresh squeezed orange juice all the time. And but, you know, I've got to go to the salt mine like everybody else.
Do a drug-filled movie that is terrible?
Yeah, I'm calling mine Maximum Overdrive 2. Cat's Eye. Wasn't there like Cat's Eye 2?
Yeah, I don't think it was really. Yeah, there was. But I don't know if he was really directly inflicted.
It just, yeah. He just put his name on it because he was doing a lot of cocaine too. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
My favorite thing though, because we actually just, John and I both just watched Maximum Overdrive not too long ago. The trailer, have you ever seen the trailer for Maximum Overdrive?
Oh, is it the one with Stephen King in it?
Yes.
Where he says, I'm going to scare the hell out of you?
Yes. It's a beauty. Because as you watch it, he can't even deny it. I mean, he literally says, I'm so tired of people not making Stephen King movies good. I decided I'd take a shot or whatever. I'm going to make a great one or whatever you're going to do. And I'm like, did you see the movie before you made the trailer?
Yes. Way to man up.
Yeah. Who made that? It's really the question that AC/DC should have been asking. All right. How do you guys feel about procedurals like Law and Order that use the ripped from the headlines approach? Does dramatizing real life events lessen the impact for you personally?
Personally, no, it doesn't. I would have to say that I prefer the 80s and 90s version of the ripped from the headlines. So Homicide, that's a different movie. Homicide: Life on the Streets was a great example of the kind of like gritty, ripped from the headlines feeling. And then early days of Law and Order always made me feel like I was watching something of importance, something that not only was it going to entertain me to some level, but it was more gritty and I can almost see how it would have really happened. And I thought that was more important. Nowadays, it feels much more gentrified, much more plasticky, and way too pretty to look at, and it doesn't feel as nice as it used to. But I gotta say, there was a episode of Homicide that will always be stuck in my mind, which is the episode where Robin Williams guest starred mm-hmm. on it.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Oh my God. Just thinking about it gives me like feelings all over the place, and like his whole performance. And he was on TV, and that back in that time, that sort of thing never really happened that much. So I think that's when that sort of thing has a lot of impact.
Kevin, what about you? Obviously, yeah. You're a fan.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I loved Homicide: Life on the Street. I love the source material, the David Simon book. I think that Andre Brower's Pembleton is probably one of the best cop characters ever on screen. It was just mesmerizing, very much like Dennis Franz Sipowicz. But those are, you know, contemporaries of Law and Order that are both far grittier. And Law and Order in the first season, the original, you know, original recipe Law and Order in the first season or two, you know, tried to be that. I mean, New York at the time was very dirty, and you know, that came through in the filming. And it did get, and I don't know if it's just coincidence, but as New York got nicer and cleaner and more gentrified, the look of the show did as well. As far as the rip from the headline stuff, I like it as a writing prompt. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a good place to go from. But I think it can be interesting when the story is used to fix the wrong that happened in real life, and to look at, you know, instead of it just being, you know, a carbon copy of what the newspaper article was, to to kind of change it a little bit, and like maybe this was the thing that you know, the twist that you didn't think about, or you know, maybe it isn't OJ, and it's you know, it's the athlete's son or something like that, you know, to change it up a little bit. But I think it's really interesting when you have the thing where the, you know, in real life the person got away or was acquitted, and but this time, you know, in the procedural they get him.
Yeah, justice is served.
Yeah.
See, I'm going to take a weird approach to it. I actually think it can make the situation a little more impactful for me when I watch it in a docudrama, because I think if I know something is a documentary, I often make a conscious choice to not watch it because I already know I will be frustrated or angry if it's like a horrible story. You know, I know the gist of it. I'm like, man, I don't want to sit through that. I would rather watch something where it's quote unquote entertainment, where you have actors and it's not the actual true life events. A dramatization feels less real. It's obviously more fictionalized. And only after it's over, for me, does it really hit me that, wow, that was actually inspired or based on a true story. So for me, a lot of times, it can actually be more impactful than the true life events, which is weird, but it's true.
I think what's stuck, where you get stuck with the whole true life events is that a lot of times you are listening to it after the fact, and it's hard to be engaged with the story when, I've said this before, when somebody is telling you the story as opposed to you seeing it laid out in front of you step by step. When somebody's just telling you a story, you have to, there's a lot more work that needs to be done, and sometimes we're just not in the mood to do that work. Does that make sense?
Well, I get more inspired, though. Honestly, if I watch a documentary, I don't feel inspired necessarily to do a bunch of research because I'm watching, you know, and these days it's like 8 episodes. I'm watching like 8 hours of this case. How much more do I need to read? I think by this point, everything should be out there. I'm not saying I don't look into it a little bit more before I form an opinion. But if it's something like Law and Order or Homicide, or if it's a show I'm watching and it says inspired by true events, I often will look into the true events and get the more the very detailed news account of what happened myself, as opposed to just taking the documentary, the filmmaker's word for it. So to me, it actually inspires me to do more work than it would if I was watching a documentary. I know that all doesn't make sense, but it works for me.
No, it kind of makes sense. Although there's one documentary where I've been flexing my bird muscles on and doing a little bit of studying and reading up on birds for.
What? What documentary is that?
Are you talking about The Staircase?
I'm talking about The Staircase.
I haven't watched that one yet. Everybody raves about it. I haven't watched it yet.
The first set of episodes is pretty great, and you actually get the case laid out in front of you, and it takes you step by step, and you're right there next to them. And you, in some case, you get, because I didn't know what the case was like when it was actually happening, I was like, what's going to happen next? What's going to go on? And you actually feel like that. But then the whole thing happens and you kind of feel a little crushed. I'm trying to be as gentle with it as possible, but there's a new theory to the case that has to do with how the murder was perpetrated, but it was more like the murderer was an owl. And knowing what I know about birds of prey, I sort of buy that theory, and I've done some more thinking and reading into it just to buy into it a little bit more.
Yeah, and I saw, you know, the new Staircase episodes, the final three. You're right, the first set of eight in that documentary, I think just superb. It's the I call it the Citizen Kane of true crime documentaries. I found that it's as much tension as is in the idea of convicting the bad guy. There is way more tension in seeing the wrongfully accused getting convicted. So you can have an opinion about whether this guy did it or not, but unfortunately the idea of the owl theory, which, you know, sounded crazy, but the more like you heard about it, you know, it definitely seems like, you know, a bird of prey like a barn owl could have swept in, you know, attacked the victim on the head, you know, causing her to stumble back down the stairs backwards because she was, you know, either she was stunned and, you know, lost her balance, or, you know, was knocked down the stairs by an owl. But they didn't really go into that, unfortunately, because I think it's a fascinating alternate theory of what happened.
Yeah. Do you guys love this new age? I mean, obviously we're all true crime fans, but do you love this new age where you have so many documentaries, so many podcasts, so many TV shows? So much is based on true crime right now, or is it too much?
Well, for somebody that does a podcast looking at true crime entertainment every week, I think it's just right. But, you know, there is a lot of stuff out there that is subpar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that there are quite a, especially in the podcast world, I mean, there are people that are of the impression that, you know, they can look at a mystery and solve it. And, you know, this isn't just the armchair detective. I mean, it's newspapers, it's radio networks. This is our idea for the thing, and we're going to send somebody out and, you know, solve the unsolved case. And it ends up being extremely disappointing because, you know, you're very rarely, if at all, going to solve that case. So you have to tell a different kind of story, or at least the question that your story is asking should be something other than whodunit, because you can't answer whodunit. So while I think there's a lot that's out there, there's not a lot that's great. So when you when something comes along that's great, I think you should celebrate it.
I think coming from the standpoint that we do a podcast on entertainment, that these last couple of months we've actually touched on the subject of when is it too much, and we've taught when do we need to unplug or pull back, or when do we need to make the decision to start cutting off things. I think we've had conversations to those levels. I think true crime is just as much into that mix as everything else is. You have to make a decision as to what you want your life to have in it, and this is just one of those things where you can spice it up with it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things that are great, how about let's go frustrating first. What has been the most frustrating true crime experience you've had, and movie or TV related? Maybe it's the case was just insane, it was absurd, it was factually inaccurate, it was just bad entertainment, whatever the case is. What's been the most frustrating one?
Well, for me, I think the two ones that I think where I was most disappointed in were Evil Genius and Wormwood. They both had a very interesting crime story to them, but were executed poorly. I thought that, you know, Evil Genius had a very interesting first episode and a fantastic second episode. And then the final two just languished and didn't really tell us anything more. Again, in part because, you know, if the question is, you know, who's behind this diabolical bank heist, I mean, we don't get an answer to that. And Wormwood, again, was, the idea of a very fascinating case. The guy who was defenestrated, which is one of my favorite words of all time, he went through the window. Was he killed because he was part of some CIA experiment? You know, it was a very interesting set of circumstances to begin with, but the way they like portrayed it with, you know, these reenactments that were cinematic and starred Peter Sarsgaard and Molly Parker, you know, just was it was like a real WTF. What is this going to be? So I get disappointed when we have an interesting crime and it is just portrayed in a ham-fisted way.
That's Evil Genius. I will absolutely concur with. I know a lot of people are raving about it, but I'm like, did you finish it? Because it doesn't end well. It just doesn't end strong.
No.
I think it's one of those things where people watch the first episode and, man, it was a great first episode. Yeah, I get that. But it didn't need four. It just didn't. It wasn't a story that needed four.
Yeah, because it ended up not going anywhere beyond that.
Right. Well, after the first episode, you're kind of afraid not to watch the second one, and after the second one, you're like, oh my god, where are they gonna find something next? And then, yeah, I liked it as a whole, but I do understand where you're coming from with the last two episodes, where nothing really happens with the exception of like languishing and somebody's mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was uncomfortable. Yeah,
and that's the point when the documentarian comes in and inserts himself back in the story, and I don't think he was necessarily a very charismatic figure who could carry the story, especially when not much else happened. You know, he talks about how, you know, he was interested in the case and he drove from somewhere in New York to, you know, to the town that the guy's in, and, you know, he's, I started taking, video of his house, and it's like, he's got like this, like, consumer grade camcorder. I'm like, what kind of video documentary was this guy thinking he was making? I mean, he's not like, you know, long of CBS News that he's not Michael Moore.
Hey, he was unemployed and bored.
Obviously.
Yeah, there you go.
Obviously. John, what about you? What's your most frustrating one you've watched?
Well, there's no one that I've watched that's the most frustrating. It's actually like a whole channel. So the majority of ID Discovery sets my teeth on edge. It's one of those things where my wife will put ID Discovery on when she's cleaning the house, or when, oh, that's never actually happens, when she's folding something, or when she's taking a nap. She listens to the show, so I'm going to get a nice gut punch for that one. Anywho, she'll put ID, now, with the exception of the times where I'll get a text message or I can hear her yelling from the other room, hey, you got to come in here and check this out. And then I go running to the other room and, hey, look, there's Kevin Flynn on my TV. Everything else about ID Discovery sets my teeth on edge because, like, I can't even sleep to it. At every single commercial break, there's some crazy white woman with piercing blue eyes that says, like, CSI quality bad murder pun, and then commercial happens. And it makes me crazy. I don't know why. And every single show, whether it's I murdered my husband was sleeping around, there's a whole lot of murdered husbands also. I don't know what we did to deserve that, but okay.
Maybe you should be concerned more that your wife is watching a lot of that.
No,
yeah,
no.
Consider the audience, yeah.
Yeah, well, I know the minute she stops watching that, I gotta go.
Or if she's like, hey, I'm going to need to hang out with my friend that you've never heard before this weekend, because that's an alibi is what that is.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, I appreciate you demurring to me, but I will admit that a lot of those shows that I've been on are crappy shows, too. And I remember the very last one I did, I recall that essentially my role was to just ask rhetorical questions so that they could then cut to something. You know, it would be like, well, what if? She's always like, well, but is this really a murder? What if he just swallowed the ass? I mean, it was just like stupid shit like that. It just was like one rhetorical question after another. I'm like, this is how, I knew exactly how they were going to use it, and I watched the episode, and, you know, that's what it was, yeah.
Oh, man. They did have something great going on for a little bit, which was the show Detective, when they had Joe Kenda on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed listening to him tell his stories, but then we started getting into this more a question of whether or not we've got the right person in custody, whether we got whether justice is actually being served. And the more I listened to the stories, the more I was like, how many innocent people did you send to jail?
Mm.
Ouch! Ouch!
So not part of the fan club?
I was
not going on the theme cruise this year with Lieutenant Kendra.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to miss out on that. No old man with PTSD for me.
Speaking of innocent people that have been sent to prison, my least favorite, most frustrating. I had such a hard time watching this, and I know a lot of people love this to death, but Making a Murderer drove me nuts. Just drove me crazy. The incompetence of the police force, the incompetence of Stephen Avery himself. He just did himself no favors at all, ever. Basically, I was just sad watching it. I felt bad about myself, society, Wisconsin, everything while I watched it. And I also felt like the series itself was very manipulative. I thought it was one-sided. I feel like it just didn't deserve my time by the time it was over. And I know people kept raving at me, like, this is the best documentary ever, and da-da-da-da. And I kept watching it going, I can't sympathize with people, except maybe the nephew. I can't understand a lot of the incompetence. I can't understand how the system failed that horribly. Not that it didn't. It obviously did. And by the end of it, I'm like, it was a little bit too long. It was a little bit too drug out. And it was just, it felt like you're only telling one side of the story. I really felt like they were never giving the other side any chance of, or I don't know, a semblance of possibly it was just, these were just mistakes, not nefarious acts, you know, and that's where I became very frustrated with that one. Am I completely alone in this?
No, you're not. You're not. I mean, I think the stuff with Brendan Dassey was very compelling, but I'm mixed and uncertain about Stephen Avery himself. And the idea that the documentarian sort of winked at the possibility that it was, I don't know, it was the brother or the boyfriend or something like that, the way they sort of like framed him up, not actually framed him, but just sort of like the way they edited him together, I thought was kind of a cheap shot. So yeah, there, I think it's it has some really great elements, but I think ultimately it's flawed.
So what has been for you, John, we'll start with you this time. What has been the most enthralling experience? Riveting, brilliantly produced, fascinating, whatever you define as the best true crime experience you've had, movie or TV related.
All right. So in, I think it was 2003, we had the release of Monster starring Charlize Theron. And she portrays Eileen Wuornos. And one of the reasons why I think that movie is such a special movie in the case of true crime has to do primarily with what Charlize Theron did that with that role, because up until this point she's done nothing but kind of like, I'm the pretty white chick in this movie, come check me out. And then we see this, which is something very real. She made some very massive changes to her physical body. She became more than just I'm the pretty girl in this to I'm an actress and you should take me seriously. And it changed everything about her, changed from that point on for me. And as far as the story itself, it's a riveting story. It's incredible to see what they did and the access that Patty Jenkins had to Eileen, because up until that point, Eileen really was closed off to a lot of people. And that's one that really just, I think is pretty great.
That's a great one. She was phenomenal in that role. I won't even say great, fantastic, whatever. She was phenomenal in that role. She deserved her Oscar. Yeah. For me, 1988, I didn't care at all for documentaries at that time. I had very little appreciation for documentaries. I mean, I was young, so I'm like, if it didn't have Indiana Jones or a wizard in it, I didn't care. There was a movie I was recommended to watch by several older friends. They said, you got to watch this movie that followed the case of Randall Adams. He was sentenced to death for the murder of a police officer. And as you watch Earl Morris's film, which was called The Thin Blue Line, in reference to the prosecutor's final remarks is what it was referring to, it becomes very apparent that the more likely suspect was Harris, another guy that was like kind of a juvenile on a crime spree. The film completely ate my soul. I had never seen anything like this before. It was really my first experience with true crime. I wanted to drive down to Texas and just and fight for this guy. I wanted to do everything I could to help him. I felt like, how could the system fail that horribly? And at the time, I was a bit lost for what I wanted to do personally, and it kind of inspired me to begin my pursuit for understanding legal avenues. I became a criminal justice major later in college. I mean, all that stuff stemmed from that particular film, because And I believe Adams got out like a year later. They finally saw the movie. The movie actually helped get him released. It's just one of the most powerful pieces of filmmaking I think I've ever seen.
That's one that's actually in my blind spot. I need to check it out.
What? Kevin, have you seen it?
I have. It was a long time ago. But yeah, definitely it was, I think, the first documentary to examine that, the wrongful conviction thing in such a way. And I believe it win an Oscar. Was it nominated for an Oscar? I just remember, Roger Ebert like raving about this film.
Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's just a beautiful work, and it still holds up to this day. I've rewatched it a couple of times, and I do not rewatch documentaries ever. So it's the only one I think I've actually rewatched. What about you, Kevin? What's been your favorite experience?
Well, see, there's so much. I'm trying to think what, would be my favorite one. I tell you, the best experience I'm having right now is a podcast called In the Dark.
Oh, and, yeah. Yes. Set him free.
Yeah. So, yes. Yeah. So, this is season two, and it's the case of Curtis Flowers. For those who haven't listened, he has been tried 6 times for the same crime. The previous 5, his convictions were either overturned due to prosecutorial misconduct or by a hung jury. He's sitting on death row. And so it looks at the weakness in the case. And right now it's the part where it's examining this white prosecutor who has prosecuted this black defendant all these years, and who has been on death row for 25 years. So it's really great journalism. It's very, and it's the kind of thing, yeah, it does get your blood boiling, and I think that's a sign of a really great true crime work.
Oh, especially the most recent episode where you learn more about the prosecutor and you're like, man, I want to beat his ass.
Oh, I know. I know. In the data journalism piece where they looked at, you know, 100,000 records to try to determine a pattern if they've been striking, you know, more black jurors than white jurors in order to rig the system. Yeah, I mean, I just think everything about this is really great. It's I would call it serial level. And, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, it might even topple Serial as being, you know, the best true crime podcast.
Their first season was pretty great, too.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it won a Peabody Award. Mm-hmm. I was this close to winning a Peabody Award.
Were you?
But yeah, I got knocked out by a Blacklist.
You're welcome. It was the Blacklist Exposed for everybody that needs the whole show title, you know. So let me ask you, in terms of film or television, though, is there anything, as much as you've seen, that really catches your eye, that you've found to be a fascinating experience?
Well, The Staircase, okay. You know, the original 8/9 episodes was great, because I did not recall the Michael Peterson case, and I didn't bother to Google it. So not knowing how it was going to turn out, you know, I just was so invested in it. And, you know, like you said, it was a real gut punch, you know, in the end when when he was convicted. And then, you know, to have the supplemental episode where they get his conviction overturned. I mean, this is the drama of it, the access to all of the players, you know, basically following the defense team in the meetings when they're trying to figure out how they're going to handle this and that. It's just a fantastic experience.
And take the level of making a murderer and multiply it by several dozen, and you get like what you get out of.
Oh, wow.
It's the access they have to them is ridiculous. You almost feel like you're in the war room with them, trying to figure out what's going on and how to answer certain questions. And to see his interactions with his kids and his brother and everybody, you really get an idea of what the person is like. Versus even with making a murderer, Stephen Avery is still kind of an enigma of a person that you really don't want to leave alone with your kids. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a completely kind of different kind of story.
And we've got a couple of listener recommendations. We asked them in our Facebook group, what would you recommend for film and TV in terms of true crime that really stuck with you? And David Koenig, he says, I remember seeing Henry Portrait, and you guys can jump in anytime if you want to speak to any of these. I remember seeing Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer in the theater when I was a kid. Messed me up. I'm actually a big fan of Monster as well. Henry's a really, really dark, dark film. That's dark. Jeff Gentry, as far as TV movies go, Zodiac was very intriguing. I've also watched all of the shows, 2020 and others, on the NX4 cult, plus Scientology, The Aftermath. Man. That's true.
Oh, that NX4 cult isn't that the one where what's-her-face from Smallville was in it? Nixium?
Yeah, I think so.
Or Nixie? Yeah.
I think so. The only cult I'd want to join. Zodiac's a good mention. That's actually a great film that doesn't get appreciated, I don't think. Let's see. Stefan Smidebeck, he says, I don't watch it to trigger that emotional vibe. It's just a watch for understanding how some people can do such unhuman acts. I like the genre, and I recommended it before. Real Detectives is really good, and you can probably find it on Netflix. We got a couple more here. John Parrish, for me, it has to be the conclusion of The Jinx. Don't want to spoil it for anyone, but when the surprise happened, it literally made the hairs on my arm stand up, and I audibly gasped. Eek, that's a great one.
Yeah, no, he's right.
He's absolutely right. I felt sick to my stomach because I just couldn't take hearing the guy when everything happened. I was just like, I had to listen to this for how long?
We've got a couple other ones here. Drew Ross, he mentions Zodiac. And also, I have to go with the OJ documentary Made in America. I think it was one of the best I've seen in years. Craig Schermerhorn mentions Mark Harmon as Ted Bundy in The Deliberate Stranger from 1986. One of my personal favorites. That thing scared the crap out of me. It just made me really fearful of Mark Harmon. But then he made Summer School and everything was okay. And Ty Nelson At Eberfest, I saw a documentary about Golden Glove boxers called On the Ropes. That's another one. One of whom was arrested and imprisoned under dubious circumstances. And then lastly, Thomas Bex. I was never really into true crime, but the Death in Ice Valley podcast by the BBC is very good. Thanks, guys. Thanks for all those. Let's move on to our closing thoughts. And before we close the show up, Kevin, is there anything you want to recommend in terms of like film or TV you maybe does not have anything to do with true crime?
I have given a lot of my my picks. I am indifferent on Westworld season 2. I can't figure out what's going on. It may have lost me. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Are you caught up? Are you
I'm
guys caught, both
yeah,
caught up?
Yeah, we're caught up. We've got the season finale coming up. Yeah, I'm still I don't know. Sorry. I can't
yeah,
even.
I only watched the first 2 episodes this season, and I can't keep with it. I just like I don't feel the draw to bring me back in.
Oh, you savages.
Sorry.
Absolute savages.
Sorry.
No. It's all right. You know, unlike what the internet seems to claim most of the time, it's okay to have a, you know, critical opinion. It's cool. Except in Westworld, because it's really a great show, and I'm just sorry you don't appreciate it for what it is. But hey, you know, teach their own.
Yeah, it's not like anyone's like doing a, you know, a Westworld podcast, so.
No. Well, actually, damn it.
Hey.
Shut up. Nobody asked for your opinion.
Got a little close to home. I got it.
Yeah, it burned a little bit. Anything else that you did like, maybe?
I am looking forward to, I haven't started watching it because of the bandwidth, but what's the new HBO one that comes on right after Westworld? The one is
Succession.
Succession, or? Yes, Succession.
Yes.
That looks interesting. I like a lot of those actors, so I'm gonna do that. And you know, I just am enjoying the great success of This Week with John Oliver. I guess I'm pretty much an HBO guy right now.
Oh, I love John Oliver. Like everything he does is magic.
Mm-hmm.
I really wish he'd lay off because I feel like Trump gets a little bit too much TV time. I mean, I would like to hear, because I think John Oliver actually covers a variety of topics intelligently. I would like to see more of those than just, here's a dumb thing Trump did this week, because we get it. Let's do some other stuff.
And sometimes you just have to go with him. So, moving on, Venezuela. Yep. And you're like, what?
Well, because of course, Venezuela.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Well, I guess this is important. I wanted to hear more about presidential blowjobs, but okay.
I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. What about you, John? You watch anything new?
All right, so to change the tone a little bit about what we've been watching, the season 6 of Voltron dropped on Netflix, and I can't say enough good things about that show. It's got so many, for a cartoon, it's got so many great layers. I love the animation style they're doing. They're doing a nice little mix of a regular flat cell animation, which I'm sure it's not, but it looks like it. But on top of that, they're doing some really great things with 3D animation, and the story is pretty layered and fun, and I just love how they've really evolved that storyline when it comes to Voltron. But I also rented a movie that we talked about a couple weeks ago that was coming out on VOD called Revenge, and it's a nice, like, revenge thriller, a throwback to exploitation movie. A girl goes on a camping trip or a trip with her CEO boyfriend, and she's the mistress, and then a couple of his other CEO friends show up, and then, you know, and then the party really starts and things get really ugly. The movie has some really interesting ideas of how much blood people have in them, and some really awesome ideas of how to use prosthetics, and has no idea what human physiology is actually like, but it's still a lot of fun and well worth the time.
Now, does your mom let you stay up late to watch Voltron?
Not often, no.
Oh, that's funny. How much chocolate milk do you drink when you watch it?
I got a big vat of it next to me. I got a whole thing of, like, I have my ice cream sandwich. Oh, it's Saturday, so it was my ice cream sandwich day? Yeah.
Of course it was Saturday, because you want to relive your entire childhood and just pretend it's like 8 a.m. in the morning. I got to watch my Voltron, Ma.
You make it sound like it's a bad thing.
No, I just mock it, as I should.
Yeah, and spend all your time texting your girlfriend in Canada.
Yeah, your wife quotes. Yeah.
Sorry you haven't seen her.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
My wife watches the podcast. Yeah. Okay, one of those internet things.
She's pretty hot, too.
I'm sure she is. Yeah, right. I finally finished Rectify, which is a really incredible story. It's very leisurely paced, but I don't say that to be an insult in any way. I really feel like it takes its time, and the main character, he was basically released from prison after being maybe wrongfully convicted for rape and murder, and he's been in there for 20 years on death row, and DNA kind of absolves him, but not completely. So there's a question as to whether he's innocent or guilty. And it's the whole series is only 30 episodes. And I think I talked about it a couple weeks ago, but I finally finished it. And it has a great ending that isn't quite exactly what I expected. But the entire show isn't really what I expected. So if you have Netflix, you can get it. You can watch the entire series. I can tell you it does have a solid ending. It is a little bit slow, but it's because of how the character is. Because the character is very confused and slow to modern social conveniences, because he doesn't understand the world, because he doesn't trust the world, and he sometimes feels like he should be back in his box as opposed to be free. So it's a fascinating character study on a bunch of characters who are broken down and then built back up, and I really think it's something people should watch. Yeah, all right, that's about all I got. And Kevin, tell people where they can find you.
You can hear me on the podcast Crime Writers On, and these are their stories, the Law and Order podcast, and you can follow me on Twitter at Kevin P. Flynn.
All right. You can join our Facebook group or on Twitter at BuyPopcorn. And I do want to say, even though I cannot spell it correctly, it is These Are Their Stories, not These Are Their Stories. So it's very important to make sure you point that out. You can find John's artwork on Insta and everywhere else at rjohn.draws, me and my other podcast, Smirk, Remake This Movie Right, The Blacklist Exposed, and Beyond Westworld, Kevin. That's a whole podcast that would explain what you don't understand.
Well, I'm going to have to binge it.
I don't feel like I can trust that you're going to do that, but that's cool.
It sounds oddly just like The Blacklist Exposed, but slightly different.
Yeah, it's very similar. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Kevin. This has been great for you to stop by for this.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Remember, the next time you head to a theater, buy popcorn.